better call
Ghostbusters.
Who you gonna call?
Ghostbusters.
I can't hear you. Who you gonna call?
And with the time just after 24 minutes past 6 o'clock in the UK, it's time for us to hand directly over to Annette Andre for another fantastic audio missive.
Well, I was recently invited to a film and media lunch to talk about my early career. And I thought you might find it interesting how a certain theme seemed to run through my work. I was trained in ballet from the age of 4, and by the time I was 15, I'd been offered a place in the most prestigious ballet company in Australia. And then came the first of a battalion of unexpected blows that ambush every performer. Someone in the company told management that I was underage and couldn't perform professionally until my 16th birthday, still nearly a year off. With the nearsighted impatience of the teenager, I packed up my ballet shoes along with my hurt and my anger and began an assault on Sydney's theatre, radio and budding television scene. Miraculously, it now seems, I quickly found steady employment in theatre and radio acting jobs, and through that began a TV career with the Australian networks. Of course, those were the live days. No retakes, and barely enough time for costume changes to prevent a Janet Jackson-type malfunction that could threaten the nation's modesty, much less mine. Those days we all played without any net. Disaster lurked in every scene, from a minefield of cables coiled to snare your feet, to speeches that suddenly ended in blank stares. The week fell by the wayside, but for those of us who muddled through, I do know that that baptism by fire produced a finer talent. By the time the American actor Peter Graves arrived in Australia to film a co-production called Whiplash, I somehow seemed to have developed a reputation for not only the bread-and-butter drawing-room comedies and dramas, but also being up for having a go at the rough and tumble of the on-location action series. And therein began my professional flirtation with death by drowning, strangulation, blunt force traumas, and an encyclopedia's worth of other exotic terminations in such series as Randall and Hopkirk Deceased, The Saint, The Avengers, The Prisoner, and, thank goodness, many others. To win the lead in a Whiplash episode, I lied, said that I was an excellent swimmer. Of course, not only couldn't I do a dog paddle, I was petrified of the water. So when filming began a few days later, there I was, not only in a rapidly running river, having been pushed out of the canoe by the heavies, but that part of the river was apparently notorious for its poisonous snakes. Within seconds of hitting the water, I was in the first and final stages of drowning. Peter quickly sussed the situation and literally grabbed and heaved me out by the drink by the seat of my pants. Somehow, they cut together a sequence that got me full marks for my derring do and aquatic prowess. Which just goes to show, when the dice are hot, the world is yours. Shortly after that, I left the sunny shores of Australia and headed for England. Several years later, I couldn't believe my luck for having been cast in the film A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, playing Philia opposite the likes of Zira Mostel, Phil Silvers, Buster Keaton, and the dishy Michael Crawford as my love interest. On my first day of filming, the director, Richard Lester, was unhappy with the way I was being lit. He had me standing for so long under the hot lights that my extreme nervousness of working with such stars suddenly overwhelmed me. Without warning, like a possum playing dead, I fell sound asleep on my feet. To this day, I don't know how long I was out, but when my eyes fluttered open, there were all the cast and crew laughing hysterically. From that day on, my daily call on the set was greeted by a rousing chorus of creative snores. I've never been so embarrassed in my life. But for the remainder of the production, sleep was the last thing on my mind. To put it kindly, Dick Lester was a madman. A qualified genius, maybe, but when it came to putting his actors in harm's way, he was without peer. In sequence after terrifying sequence, I'm in a chariot driving a team of gigantic horses through dense forests at supersonic speeds. Yeah, that's me up on the screen. No stunt double careening over rocks and barely missing low-hanging branches, let alone the trees. That's also me dangling from a slender wire, being hauled up to the top of an 80-foot golden dome. My death grip on the rope, the only safety net that Mr. Lester provided. And I had to do it four times. But these heart-stopping stunts were more than repaid by Zero Mostel taking me for art history tours of the Prado when he discovered that, like himself, I was a painter. Or dear Buster taking on the role of my surrogate father when he thought I was too innocent to safely navigate the macho Spanish scene. In retrospect, I was blessed time after time by the old China hand actors I was so lucky to work with from the start. Stars such as Dame Sybil Thorndike took me under her wing during the West End run of Vanity Fair and gave me lessons in stagecraft. Roger Moore was indeed a saint when, in the first of many saints I guest starred in, and was almost my last, the foul-mouthed director let loose a torrent of abuse when I blew a key line in the first take in the first scene. Roger took him aside and quietly said a few words. Then he came to me, took my hand, and turned the episode into a joke. Laughter, he said, was the best revenge. How right he was, and it rescued me on many occasions. But on the other hand, the theatre offered me little or no real relief from mayhem, as you think it might. For example, on the opening night of The Collector, I was playing Miranda to Brian McDermott's Clegg in a scene where he throws me onto the bed to tie me up. He threw me so hard, my head hit the brass bedhead and knocked me out. When I came to seconds later, I was still saying my lines. No, please, no! But at the same time, literally seeing stars. I was so disoriented at the end that as we walked forward to take our bows in a blackout, I walked straight off the stage and landed on a man's foot in the first row. They hauled me back up, and I managed to see it through. And then in the West End production of Business of Murder with Richard Todd, I suffered mayhem of quite another sort. Every performance in our first scenes, Richard would edge close and sort of sniff to see if I'd eaten garlic for lunch or dinner. The slightest whiff would subject me to a screaming lecture after the show that my carelessness was directly responsible for his, Richard's, not giving the audience a top-flight performance they had paid for. The lives of all performers are filled with anecdotes like these. Colourful slices culled from days, weeks, years of hard work that can thankfully be reduced to a collage of laughs, if you're lucky enough to be on the right side of the footlights. I've had a great time playing saints and sinners and being paid for the privilege to boot. In theatres the world over, the lights are turned off after the last performance except for one left burning stage centre. It's called the Ghost Light, and it's there for all the spirits who trod those boards to find their way back. I like to think that one day, in the very, very distant future, I'll find a ghost light burning for me. Oh, there's nothing I'd like better than to hear my cue, hit my mark, and do it all over again.
We'll be right back.
Of course, that was the series, Annette, where you were able to go to the south of France to actually film in The Persuaders.
The Persuaders, yes.
Oh, exactly.
Yes, I did.
And you mentioned, of course, a funny thing happens on the way to the Forum. A film takes place in the city of Rome sometime during the reign of Emperor Nero, played by Zero Mostel, of course.
We actually filmed that in Madrid.
Did they?
Outside of Madrid.
Interesting that the cinematographer was a young man called Nicholas Rogue.
That's right.
He
was the one that I fell asleep on.
Many people have actually said the same when they've looked at The Man Who Fell to Earth, you know, just fall asleep. You know, sorry, Nicholas, it's nothing personal, but you just, well, whatever, you know.
I know. I mean, they all wondered what had happened. I just sound asleep. I was so nervous.
So nervous. You hibernate.
I just went...
Exactly, you know. Hibernate. I mean, in my particular case, just cough all over the star guest. Well, whatever, you know, it's all part of the past routine. Somebody who would never actually cause people to fall asleep in his cast has to be whom, Holly? You know, who could this possibly be?
Might this be Phil Leonis?
Might this be Phil Leonis? Hey, Phil Leonis, welcome to the show. How are you, sir?
It might indeed be Phil Leonis.
Yes.
I think that's the kindest thing that's ever been said about me. And I would like... In fact, what a great epitaph that would be. Here, who lies here? It might indeed be Phil Leonis. I'm doing wonderfully well, and it was interesting because I, this week, instead of just listening to the show and taking notes, I actually had pre-notes done because I knew Miss Andre was going to be on the show, and I had wanted to ask about a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum.
Yes.
So how thrilling was that to get to hear the story? Because when I was a freshman in college, back in 19... I hit it off immediately with my roommate, who I had never met before, but one of the things that we immediately hit it off on was the fact that he had... A video, a VHS back then, of A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, and we both immediately tried to impress each other with our knowledge of Nicholas Rogue, because of course I was a budding film student, so
right.
this was a big deal. But we didn't reveal our kind of hidden ulterior motives as to why we were watching this movie again and again and again, which was he had actually appeared in a production of the musical back in his early school days, and because of course I had a huge crush on Annette Andre, so this was why we were watching this every week in our dorm room.
So. You have been primed, and you've just said the right words.
Annette Andre as Philia. There we are, in the cast list that we actually have there, in full sort of four.
Have you got a photo?
That's on radio, Holly. I'm sure we'll see what can actually work here. Exactly.
But if I can hold court for just a minute, Alex, for the benefit of Holly and Emma, to talk about Miss Andre for just a moment and her work. If they get the chance to watch, and many of these shows, of course, are available on DVD and streaming, and I'm sure, Alex, you probably have them in the studio and are forcing them to watch them anyway, because that's what you do. But the thing that's astonishing, because fortunately we live in an age where now seeing strong women who embody decency and integrity is not, it might not be commonplace still, but it is not the rare exception. And yet, that was the thing that always struck me about the roles that Annette played, was that she really stood out because every bit as beautiful as you could possibly imagine, but this uncommon... there's this phrase here, common decency, and I've always been troubled by that phrase because I've found that decency is incredibly uncommon. And in your performances, Annette, there always is this just uncommon decency that comes through. And so by the time I am becoming a huge fan of The Prisoner, which was a show that at times had an uncomfortable message about women, because
yes,
I mean, this is a show this was a show where Patrick McGoohan's character even says at one point, never trust a woman, even the four-legged variety, meaning cats.
Yeah.
And yet your character turns up and almost shames him into doing the right thing just by, your own integrity. And as I know from working with actors as a filmmaker and a storyteller, yes, of course people are playing different characters, but when they do so, and when they do so believably, it's because they're revealing something about themselves. And so I would urge Holly and Emma to really avail themselves of her work, because it was a time when it seemed to me there weren't a lot of roles that showed the nobility of women on television. Too often they were the damsels in distress or the femme fatales or, you know, some kind of limited masculine projection of women. And yet with Annette, it was almost always this fully formed and honorable woman.
That is probably one of the nicest things I've ever listened to. You really got me a bit choked up there.
Well,
thank you so very much.
That's the kind of magical connection of being part of the Midweek Drive family.
Oh, it's lovely.
Very good.
Well, every week, maybe a new segment, Alex, where I do a letter about Annette Andre from Southern California.
Well, I'm also thinking you should surely actually look to feature both Annette and Arthur Weingarten in the Chill Pack Hollywood routine. I see you've got the cough that obviously is transferred across the Atlantic there. It's all right, don't worry, it's not Ebola. You can't catch it from the internet, okay?
Well, this is not the actual cough that's been with me for several weeks. This was just getting startled by something and drinking down the wrong pipe.
By the way, Phil, if you don't know where we are now in California.
Yes, I did realize that.
No, it's the emotion of it all. You know, it's just too much. Breathe. Quick, Lily, give him a panic maneuver, for God's sakes.
So technically, Annette, I don't want to shock you, but actually right now you're in Lincoln.
You know that,
Yes, I've been in those self-same glamorous, well-appointed studios in which you currently find yourself.
Yes, and great fun it is, too. I'm having an enormously good time.
There we are.
That would be wonderful. I would love to get to do a show with you and your husband.
Yes.
That would be wonderful.
Yes. Well, you've been in touch with Arthur at some point last year, I think it was.
Italy. Absolutely, yeah.
We'll work on that. And as I said, obviously, Holly and Emma will be looking to get you flown over as well to take part in the it's always important to you.
I was just going to say, I thought Phil was going to say, oh, actually, I'm in Lincoln. Oh, that's exciting.
Not only should you fly, not only should Holly and Emma fly over, but given their definition of showrunner, we could probably even give them a showrunner position. Totally in charge of coffee.
Coffee and tea.
Yeah, exactly. So,
Katie Grimerson has texted in to say she's just got back from work and is now employed at a small marketing firm in the jewellery quarter of Birmingham. So well done, Katie Grimerson. There you are, you see. It's marvellous. A little nod of the hat as well to, of course, Gareth. I was going to say Gareth Edwards. Of course, he's the director. Gareth Owen. Yes, exactly. Of course, doing wonderful stuff. There we are. Just make sure we tick all the boxes. So that would be very important.
I missed the first few minutes of the show. Did we wish Cameron Tilbury a happy birthday?
We did.
Okay, in full force.
All right, I just want to make sure, you know, because I'm always school closings and celebrity birthdays. I'm always in charge of.
This is the critical side of things. Excellent. Annette, have you got any questions you want to put to Phil about life and times over in Los Angeles? Because obviously you've been out of the whole sort of California area for a couple of months now.
Well, yes, I have, and also. Because we lived in, we did live London and New York and LA. Then, of course, we went to New York for all those years. Now we're back in California, but haven't had time to suss the situation, particularly LA. So what is your view on the situation over there now?
We need water. We desperately need.
I was going to ask you about that, Phil, because last week I said, what's the weather like? And you said it's awful. But I actually checked for you the weather forecast in LA today. And apparently there's chances of rain, so there's hope. But we've got plenty here in Lincoln if you want to come and visit and gather some rain.
Can I be filled in on
this?
There's a drought in LA.
Right. Yes. In California.
In California. There are entire counties in the state of California now that are absolutely without water. When they turn on the tap, nothing comes out. So water is being trucked to them. I think we're down to something like 12% of the water reserve. And it does occur, and this is what really for years has always occurred to me whenever there would be debates about, oil pipelines being built or pipelines in the Middle East and people saying that the reasons for this kind of international activity, be it war or partnership or whatever, was about oil and building pipelines. And it always occurred to me that the conversation that was not being had was about future water shortages that could be predicted, because many parts of the world that fight over oil were fighting over water long before they were fighting over oil. And when we've moved beyond the need for fossil fuel, we will still be fighting over water.
Yeah.
And all those pipelines will serve to transport water at some point. And the interesting thing is when the International Monetary Fund or when companies buy mineral rights from certain countries, developing countries, poor countries, countries in debt, one of the rights they get is to the water, which I think will become a larger and larger issue in terms of global conflict as we
move forward. Yes, absolutely. You're absolutely right.
Tell you what, I'm going to stay living in England.
Very important, because you can always buy bottled water from the supermarket.
Oh, the sea is much closer to you than it is in America.
No, don't buy bottled water. That's the other thing, is that the bottled water, one bottle of water, follow me on this map. I mean, I was told when I became a filmmaker there would be no map, but one bottle of water to produce that plastic bottle...
Mm. Yes.
Requires the equivalent of 20 bottles of water.
Oh, dear.
We're wasting 20 times that amount of water to
make a bottle.
The bottle itself. And, I love a certain brand. I won't promote the brand by mentioning it, but there's a certain brand of water that I have always loved. It's been wonderful. It tastes great. It's got the most aesthetically appealing bottle. And then, of course, I stopped to think about the fact that it's being flown to me from one of the last dictatorships on Earth, a country where 80% of their population is denied water so that I may pay $5 to enjoy their water. And, we have to change our relationship to it. I mean, that's my individual responsibility, because obviously I can't create policy, but I can start to try to live in the world that I would like to live in, where we're not scared of using tap water.
Absolutely.
And so,
in case you're wondering, Phil, Jessica Ward has not left the series just because she actually was born in New Zealand, and there might have been a tension between, obviously, Annette's Australian roots and Jessica's New Zealand roots. I want to make that quite clear.
Oh.
She's playing netball and will be with us tomorrow morning. Okay? So very important that's there.
Why do you constantly bring up the ongoing feud between Lucy Liu and myself?
I just mentioned that obviously Holly had risen, had raised the elementary series, and as I obviously said, pointing it out, it has Lucy Liu in it.
Everyone knows you're hinting at something. Look, I'm going to now artfully change subject. When I was hearing
Lucy
the conversation
Liu is not
about...
playing netball, okay? That's all I shall say. She's not playing
How
netball.
How do you know that? She might be.
Fair point.
So the conversation was had earlier about, nerves in terms of interviewing famous people. And I don't know if I've ever shared this story, but more than 10 years ago, I used to direct and produce behind the scenes making of documentaries about feature films. You know, these bonus features that mm-hmm. appear on DVD releases of films. Mm-hmm. And I would do many of these, and I developed a reputation for being very good in terms of handling the talent and interviewing the talent, building rapport with them. And so a company contacted my employers and said, we're making a documentary about the making of a film, and the lead actress is, probably they used the word difficult, maybe they used more colorful words, who knows. But they wondered if I could be loaned out to them for the purposes of conducting this interview. And so I said, yes, you know, we've rented out a location, we're going to be doing interviews all day. If you schedule her to come during this period of time right after our lunch, then that would be perfect, and we'll handle that interview for you. And so I sent my crew to lunch, and I was doing a depth psychology workshop in my personal hours, always trying to improve myself, always trying to learn. Education should be a lifelong pursuit. So I was taking this depth psychology workshop, and part of the opening assignment was to fill out this incredibly personal questionnaire, because the idea was that there's no better way to learn about these depth psychology principles than by applying them to your own psyche. And so I was spending my lunch hour filling out this deeply personal questionnaire. And this actress, this performer, comes early, shows up early. Her makeup team, her wardrobe team, no one has shown up yet. She arrives early without any handlers. My crew is on lunch. And I have to admit, I was a little bit nervous because these horror stories had been shared with me about how difficult, supposedly, she was. And so at that moment, I had two choices. I could either be frightened or I could not be frightened. So I chose not to be frightened. And I simply, you know, introduced myself. I apologized, saying, you know, the crew was gone. Her team had not shown up yet. But she said, no, that's okay. I kind of had hoped that I could come early and maybe look at what questions you were going to ask me. So I set her up. You know, I gave her my canvas director's chair, said I would, you know, get the questions. I would get her a beverage. Make her comfortable. So she sits down, and I leave, and when I come back, she's reading something. And I realize she's reading this personal questionnaire that I had been filling out about my own life, experiences, his feelings. Yes, and I start to turn crimson,
awkward.
And I said, no, I'm sorry. I said, no, those are not the questions that you're going to be asked. Here are the questions you're going to be asked. And she looks up, and she looks at me blankly, and I am still very crimson, and I said, I'm sorry that you had to read this. And she said, no, not at all. At least now I know what kind of sexual partner you think you are. And
that's California.
And anyway, and what followed was, from that moment on, she could not have been any more of an angel to the crew, to her team. It was a delightful interview, and we are friends to this day. And so the worst thing that possibly could have happened did, and it ended up being just a wonderful icebreaker.
There we are. Quick, cue the universe.
The thing that most forget while dreamily looking off into the horizon for the ship of their dreams is that such ships never sail in, but are actually built beneath their very feet. Oh, we owe the universe.
Splendid. Annette, we've reached the time where we almost have to say farewell, but I feel it's only right, having seen Emma and Holly do the stuff, etc., for you to ask for Leonis those last two questions. They're always put in all sorts of ways. We'll ask you them as well, but Annette, would you like to ask Phil, has he had a reasonably interesting time, and is he coming back again?
Well, to begin with, will you come back again?
Nice inflection. Very good.
Of course. They can't keep me away. I've got nowhere else to be.
In which case, I don't have to ask you. I have to say, you obviously enjoyed it very much, because I know I did.
Well, there's nothing better. What better, you know, what could be more fun than spending a half hour with friends?
Lovely.
And Annette, have you enjoyed your first two-hour extravaganza as a full co-presenter on the Midweek Drive?
Oh, I've had a wonderful time. Next time I come back, I'll let you know. I'll come in again.
It's sorted. Emma, have you enjoyed the programme?
I have very much enjoyed myself.
And Holly?
As always.
I know you want a photograph just with yourself and Annette, so I'll try and get this, because otherwise you should be held next week. Who knows what could actually happen. We'll be back tomorrow morning, 8 o'clock, which is, of course, midnight, so just after midnight Los Angeles time. Coming up next, we've got Craig Wiley with a whole range of other factors, and, of course, Siren Lifestyle. Thanks to Cameron Tilbury. Happy birthday, Cameron. Thanks to Richard Edwards, to Owen Glacken, Taryn Bennett, and, of course, Phil Leonis and Annette Andre and Emma Tinson and Holly Parker. And thank you, dear listener. That's it. That's a wrap. We can only go out really with one tune. What do you think that tune and theme might possibly be, Phil Leonis?
Town Called Malice.
Tragically, no. It's this one. Next week, maybe. But anyway, Annette Andre, we salute you. Take care. Happy trails.
Thank you.